This is Social Europe Podcast. We are dedicated to strengthening democracy by discussing the most pressing political, economic, and social issues of our time. So welcome and enjoy the conversation.
Mark Lai, thank you very much for joining me again on Social Europe Podcast. This is now the third in a series of conversations we've had on the Trump administration. I remember very vividly about a year ago, just before the inauguration, we had our first episode. And you were saying basically there's no data to go by, right? It could be the case that absolutely nothing happens. Right. And it could be that all hell breaks loose. So 1 year on, I would say we're probably more towards the all hell breaks loose side of the spectrum. So how do you assess the first year of the Trump administration?
Well, I don't want to use the word worse than that as a pejorative. So let's put it this way. Things have accelerated faster than I ever thought. So let's go back and recap a few things. How many people had Canada and Greenland on their bingo card? Right.
Nobody.
Exactly, right. But to a certain extent, you know, people had been saying this beforehand that if there is a kind of foreign policy break that goes along with this kind of new anti-globalist thing, it does seem to be a kind of, how to put it, balance of power, hemispheric spheres of alignment. That was in the air. It's just that it was fanciful. It was tea leaves. There was nothing to go on. And literally the moment they get in, it's like Canada should be part of this and we're going to take Greenland. Interesting now, you know, in terms of the multilateral institutions, they haven't been savaged or attacked yet, but they're only a year in, so give it a chance. But if you notice, you know, who is it that basically gets the attention of multilateral institutions now, like the World Bank, etc., IMF, etc., it would be Argentina. It would be El Salvador. It would be people, it's probably going to be Chile now, but they don't need it. But essentially, it's people who are, let's say, right-wing, qua-libertarian partisans who run the satraps in the South. So that's one big thing, right? Second one, the one that really got me, I have done a bunch of talks. There's one that's up at the LSE. We've spoken about this stuff before, about how I thought all the Biden stuff on the green transition, the IRA, etc., was all going to get torched. And sort of the general opinion was, no, because, you know, if you're a Republican but not a MAGA Republican and you're on a state like Georgia or Arizona or one of these places, you've got all this investment coming and, you know, why would you screw it up? Why would you do without it? And my answer was because there's an existential fight between carbon assets in the US and basically non-carbon assets. And what I thought would happen over the next couple of years is that through a process of denial of funds, litigation, contestation, etc., that there would be a winding back of this. Everything happened all in 1 year. I mean, there's attempts to ban windmills. I mean, you know, it's not, it is funny, but it's not funny. It's so China doesn't have any windmills. It's like, what? But then you're-
And apparently they're making a loss of $1,000 every time they turn.
Every time they turn, right. And, you know, this is the guy who, remember, can't do percentages. You know, we're going to take drug prices down by 5,000%. What does that even mean, right? But nonetheless, right, there was that. What else has happened? IRA has been gutted, repurposed, weaponized. The bits that they need, such as batteries. Who do you get your batteries from? Not the Chinese, you need it from the South Koreans. So what do? You send ICE into a battery factory that's under construction and arrest all the Koreans, right? And that happened within like the first 2 months, right? So the speed, I mean, if you look at the executive orders on clean coal as like a new fuel, as if it's the 18th century. If you think about the AI build out, how that's straining electricity grids, how all of that's going to be met by gas rather than anything else, not renewables, gas primarily. I mean, it's all happened and it's happened so astonishingly fast. It's happened in 1 year. So that's geopolitics on one side. That's decarbonization on the other side. Foreign policy, I mean, you guys are just like hopeless. You guys deserve to be like abandoned, and it's all your fault. The only reason you ever had the welfare state was America because you didn't spend any money on defense, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And what's really been surprising about that has just been how supine the Europeans have been on this one. And we can talk about why. I'd like to get into that, actually, about sort of, you know, the threat that Europe's the biggest foreign investor and why that's not really a weapon you can use, etc. But just want to say one thing on this one. And it's very important. The notion that sort of the Europeans built the welfare state because they weren't spending money on defense, this is the easiest one to consistently refute. If you go back and look at defense spending in the 1950s and the 1960s and 1970s, when welfare states were built and when they were at their zenith before they started to be basically whittled away in the 1990s, that's when you begin to see the sort of like the, you know, the decline in support, the decline in defense spending. But when these things were built, the Brits were spending up to 6% of GDP. The Scandos were on 3.5. The Germans were 3.5 to 4. So this notion that sort of we've been free riding for 60 years, utter bullshit, right? Like basically Europe built their welfare states when they were also doing very high defense spending. Now, what's happened is those countries got old. Their productivity has declined, their growth rates have gone, and basically that creates problems for pension systems, which have become much larger than anyone thought, et cetera, et cetera. But the notion that sort of that Europe has been free riding on this is just rubbish. Now, has there been any contestation of this? No, the Europeans have just taken it and walked with it. And that to me is the truly fascinating bit. You know, it's like Carney's speech at Davos, right? Either you take the sign out the window or you don't. It's like the Europeans are like, would you like two signs?
Yeah, I mean, as you know, we're fretting on eggshells, right? So the same goes also for non-EU if you look at what Starmer or how Starmer is approaching US policy. So, I mean, I think over here, people have not made sense yet out of the situation that you're being treated like that. Mm-hmm. You're still negotiating, you come to some sort of agreement. That agreement is worth probably a week or two. Until it's being renegotiated or something else comes up and you're being threatened again. So there's absolutely nothing to go by. While at the same time, you know, you're starting, we've got to get to that later as well, you know, what Europe can do. You started quite clearly a process of becoming more sovereign or decouple in certain areas from the dependency that you have on the US. And especially for Germany, where I'm based, as you know, it's a hard lesson because we've learned about dependencies in recent years an awful lot, right? Not least on Russian energy and all sorts of other dependencies. So I think there is an awareness now. But you know, Europe is slow moving, as you know, right? So the European Union as an institution is very slow moving. It's always a coordination effort. Obviously, the United States has got a strategy of pick and choose some favorites amongst EU member states. So as in a national security strategy quite clearly outlined. They're also hostile in the sense that, you know, it really started with J.D. Vance about a year ago at the Munich Security Conference, you know, claiming that there's no freedom of speech in Europe and, you know, the great replacement theory and all the rest of it, right? So people take a bit of time here to make sense out of that, really, what it actually means in practice. And but the wheels are moving. And I think what the awareness here is no matter whether there's going to be a massive democratic landslide in the midterms or whether there's going to be another democratic president 2 years' time, the situation ex ante is gone. So there's no going back to the situation as it was before Trump started his second
term.
Yeah,
and that's important. It's important. And it's not because, you know, the Democrats, if they get in, which is still dubious, if they return, you know, they're insincere. It's just that you can't make policy on 3-year cycles. Right, you can't do it. So a great example of this is actually domestically in terms of electric vehicles. So of all the US car companies that went into this, Ford probably went the furthest, bringing out the electric Mustang, the electric F-150 truck, the Lightning, doing all this sort of stuff. And then, boom, it's all gone. All the subsidies are gone. You know, we don't want to do this. Just keep building, you know, cars as we've done before. So they've had to burn an enormous amount of capital in this. Like billions of dollars have gone up in smoke. Now, let's say the Democrats come back and they go, we're going to do this again. If you're Ford, you're like, good luck. Right? Why on earth would you take that risk? And it's going to be exactly the same for any partners as well. But that's when the dependency issues come back into this, right? Ford isn't really dependent on government strategy to sell cars. We could caveat that. The only reason that Americans drive big trucks is because of a tariff that's been there forever on the importation of open back trucks. But anyway, Pickup trucks, I should say. But, you know, they're not directly dependent in that way. They can be incentivized to go a certain way. And if the incentives change, you know, they'll go another way. But what you have in Europe, both on sort of energy security now because of LNG exports or LNG imports, I should say, on the European side, and a lack of like Russian alternatives. What you've got on the security side, because you've still got no comprehensive system of built purchasing or manufacturing in Europe, and the dependencies that go with that. And then the export dependencies. I mean, to me, the debate in Germany is the most interesting one, whereby there seems to be an awareness of all of the symptoms, but no diagnosis of the cause of the weakness, which is that if at the end of the day you're the export Weltmeister, then you are completely dependent on other people buying your stuff on terms that make sense to them. And once those people have decided, we're not going to weaponize this now, as China has done, as they've moved up the product cycle, and the Americans do through tariffs, you can't do an export-led growth strategy anymore. And there seems to be zero recognition of this.
Well, there is the beginnings of that. I mean, the two elements in particular. One is the exception for defense spending in the constitutional debt break, right? So, I mean, admittedly, it's mainly consumptive spending, but you could make, and that's the discussion here at the moment, which I think, you know, should progress pretty swiftly, is you can make a dual use argument about all sorts of investments in technology. So whether it's quantum computing, whether it's AI, you know, obviously, these technologies have a dual-use component to them. And if you finance investments into these areas as you know, through the exemption and the debt break, there's virtually unlimited spending potential in these areas. So that's one area to make use of. The second one is the $500 billion infrastructure investment fund. As you know, that's a catch-up fund more than anything. But at least after long last, as you know, after at least two decades or 20 years, you know, that investment is being put into place. So over the next 12 years, you know, there will be a significant amount of spending, and in the first years, it's not the amount of money that's the constraint. It's literally the ability to actually spend it all wisely and get it all done. Right.
Absolutely.
So effectively, the federal budget is almost a doubling of investment spending in the next few years. So it's, and in the long term perspective, the 12 years is important, as you know, for companies to build up capacity that they know,
have confidence that they're going to be able to do it. There has to be actually a consolidation of the defense industry. I mean, essentially, the Italians, the Brits, the Germans, and the French kind of need to do the consolidation that the Americans did at the end of the Cold War into basically three or four big companies that are transnational. And the only way you can do that is if you really make progress on a capital markets union, and that's where it gets really, really difficult. Because basically the domestic banking systems in these countries, ex-UK, really don't like that. They really don't want that. They're quite happy to have the Italian system. I found this out a little while ago, that when you can open a savings account in some Italian banks and they don't tell you how much they're going to give you in interest. Right, they have like a covered deposit scheme. And you're like, you got to be kidding me, right? So basically, when interest rates drop, like your interest rate spread goes up, you make more money, you don't have to pass it on to the depositors. I mean, if you have like little micro inefficiencies like this that allow these tiny little banks to survive, you would need to have a government that goes, all of this has to go. And it has to go in such a way that it unifies across the continent. And sadly, you know, the people, as you know as well as I do, the people who are in the polls are more concerned with windmills, Alice, for example, and migrants everywhere else. So bloody hard to get that one going.
Yeah, I mean, it will be difficult to move on these inefficiencies. But if you get to the economic situation in the States for a moment, I mean, I get the impression more and more that this is really built on sand, especially if you look at, you know, where the stock market increases came from. It's basically the big tech firms, right?
Yeah, AI build out. Absolutely.
It's all AI. And to my mind, as far as I can tell, OpenAI is the canary in the coal mine,
right?
And it's showing signals that it's running out of steam, because you know their price, their valuations are based
on
you know, we're going to reach AGI in 2 to 3 years,
and they keep saying that. No, absolutely, yeah. and not just that. It's not clear what they do when they get there, right? I mean, I have this like skit that I run in my head whereby one of these guys walks into the office one day and the computer says, "Good morning, Dave," and then you go, "All right, so what do we do now? We have sentience." Way the stock market goes, what's it going to do, right? The end of the day, you have to have firm business uses for this. But you know, actually potential use cases. And this is where the Chinese open source models are basically, you know, being downloaded all over the world for a reason, because basically they're open source and you can use them. And at all Mars, what happens is at the app level, and what you, if you look at the figures on this, there's a really interesting paper by the Man Group on this, that if you look at the figures, 50% of the query applications that go up to AI are what they call kind of hobbyists. It's basically families going, all right, I'm pretty sure that Catherine the Great didn't marry a horse. Did Catherine the Great marry a horse? That's what's going up, right? So, you know, the business case is shaky at best. Now, do
you
need
a nice recipe for dinner?
It could do, exactly, right. Now, but the thing is this a powerful technology as it progresses? Yes, it is. And if you never get to AGI or whatever fantasy you've got, you've still got a very useful technology. I mean, I use it, right? All the rest
absolutely,
of it.
Absolutely.
And again, but this is somewhere else where Europe, to flip it back, right? Yes, there may be an AI bubble. Yes, it may hit the stock market. Yes, that may have these consequences. But the thing is, America still has AI and the clouds and the data. Europe doesn't have any of that because it regulated the ability of a European AI to actually train its data out of existence. This is why the one German company that was an AI buggered off to the United States. Like, you can't do it because of the regulations.
Yeah, but hold on. This is where it gets really interesting. I mean, the clearest sign to me that they've hit a sort of buffer or plateau in the LLM development is not just what Sutskever and other researchers, actual researchers saying where they are. It's basically, you can see it in the business model, right? So the valuation of AI, of OpenAI is premised on AGI in 2 to 3 years. Nobody apart from Altman seriously claims this anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But then monetizing now very aggressively what they have. Sora 2, a TikTok clone with AI slop where you can put yourself into any situation.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Advertising on OpenAI, sex chatbots. So that
agents, the whole lot, shitification has come really fast, right? But don't celebrate this too fast, because ultimately what they've got is a way that's going to disintermediate the web over the long run. And at the same time, it depends on the web for its learning data. So, you know, I is there a bubble? Yes. Is it going to hurt? Yes. Is my 401k going to take a 20% hit? Yes. Okay, unless it's the end times, then basically whenever there's major equity corrections, within 18 months, you get 50% back. So a whole bunch of tech firms will go and shit a lot of money. A lot of private equity people that put money into them will also die. I'm not going to cry about that. Will this destroy the American economy? No, it'll basically make it look a lot more like Europe. But at the same time, it still has that tech. It still has the clouds. It still has the infrastructure. And that's
absolutely
what's fundamentally important.
But if the current discussion seems to be that the LLMs, the basic models, are becoming commodified, right? So it's either for free, like, you know, China dropping DeepSeek R1 or something like that. Or you can use the API to basically, buy the LLM very cheaply.
Yeah. Let's look at it apart from the stock market effects then, right? Is it possible that this will have a big impact on employment, right? Now, we don't know. I have the comforting thought that the biggest job in the most demanded job in the United States by volume for the past decade or more has been elder care nurse, right? There's no app for that, right? So at the end of the day, how much of this is really going to affect the labor market? Where it's going to affect the labor market, and you already see it, is in entry-level jobs for university graduates. And once you start hitting the middle classes and the upper middle classes, scions and their employment prospects, that's when this is going to get really ugly really fast. And that's going to hit both Europe and the United States. So even if there's a bust, you know, there's a secondary problem on the horizon that isn't good news for anyone.
No, but there's a lot of scope to shape this. David Alter from MIT had a very interesting paper out. They published it also as an MBRR paper.
Mm-hmm.
And he makes the argument that AI can actually be used to rebuild middle-class jobs, because he thinks it's all about augmentation rather than replacing of existing labor.
Well, that's a hope. I'm a businessman. I'm interested in costs. If I can augment someone and make them more productive, I will. If I can replace them and get even more money, I will. That's an open question as to how that plays out single decision.
But so far, the evidence on replacement is reasonably thin.
I'm not really an expert on this. We're all basically off our reservation at this point. I don't think this is the core of where we need to be to discuss what's going on with Europe and the United States at the moment. There's a kind of like schadenfreude here whereby it's just wait, you guys went long AI and then you'll be screwed and we'll be fine. I don't think that's really the case.
I don't think it's about schadenfreude. The thing is, if that situation is like LLMs are commodified, I think the race will start again from sort of go from the get-go again. Because then the value added is about how you, as you mentioned before, apply those models.
Yeah, it's appification.
With proprietary data that mm-hmm. you have in specific applications. So, and Europe is nowhere, I mean, apart from Mistral, you know, the French LLM company, but nowhere in foundation models, right?
Right.
Apart from DeepSeek, this being based in London, right? So, by being part of Google. But that's clear. I mean, that race has been lost. But the chatter here is that lead of the US could be evened out in a sense if the basic LLMs are being commodified and the race for useful application of the technology starts from scratch.
Yeah, no, that could be on second one. I mean, the thing is, you're going to have to build your own cloud infrastructure. Like you can't really sort of, you can't have the foreign policies that we're going to have over the next 10 years if it continues in this direction and rely on US cloud infrastructure and have any sort of AI security.
Absolutely.
To happen as well, right?
Yeah. You have to build that. Absolutely. But the most interesting recent stuff from, you know, Silicon Valley is apparently full of it. Have you heard of Clawbot or Moldbot, or changed the name a few times?
No.
You can build your own AI agent.
Agental AI, absolutely.
This is a single Austrian developer, a single guy who actually put it out on GitHub, on open source at the end of last year, and it now blew up. Because you can basically connect everything together, you know, an API with an LLM, but it's apparently very insecure, right? So it leaks tokens and all the rest of it. But I mean, the interesting thing here is, I think, where one single person, in that case from Austria, can come up with an interesting application of the technology. So, and yes, that's to my mind, is a bit like, you know, supporting the argument that the race, in a sense, is open again, because it's really about how do you apply the technology rather than the hobbyist asking redundant questions.
Well, two ways to think about it. And again, you know, I'm not an expert on this, but I've been making this argument consistently, so at least I get points for consistency, right? So the first one is, if the argument is we will have very high walls and we will have moats and we will have people inside our ecosystem, we will win the race, we will have godlike AI, everyone will come to us and they'll all pay a fortune, that's obviously not going to happen, right? Now, is it the case that certain firms that have just been doing this and learning by doing, and you can see the way that it shifts between Gemini and then it's Claude and it's something, right? That these models are basically being used by different communities that are discovering different capacities in them. For example, Claude is probably the end of people who are experts on pivot tables in Excel. Done, right? Is that a huge disruption to the world? If you work in finance, it is. So, you know, will these things continue to work and it's at the app basis? Yeah. And basically what that means is one or two of these firms might take a big punch in the face or die. Small firms may come up and appify the whole thing. But, you know, in a sense, let's take an analogy to that. So Apple runs the ecosystem and then you basically run the apps and you pay them 30%. I could imagine a world in which it works like that, in which basically the big American firms are still running it, principally because they have the cloud infrastructure in which you would be able to work.
Unless the Chinese dump the models open source.
You've got to run them somewhere. Right? Yeah. You have to run them on cloud. Those clouds are proprietary American clouds. That's why Oracle's building out so much.
Yeah, I mean, if you tailor the LLMs for specific applications, you can run much smaller models. But principally, you're right. You're right. I mean, that is certainly one of the things that Europe has to be doing. I mean, we'll come back to you in a second, but I wanted to ask you about the situation domestically in the United States, obviously with the ICE crackdowns and what happened in Minneapolis, and it's a very worrying drift into.
This is stuff that people were seeing as kind of like tail risk before the election.
Yes.
Which, you know, you had people like Miller and others basically quite openly saying that, you know, we're going to deport, you know, how many million people. And you start thinking, well, how many is that a month? Whew, that's a tough order. How are you going to do that? What's the logistics? Then you see that the first budget that goes through, part of the big, beautiful bill, is basically ICE gets more funding than the FBI. That you go onto Twitter and it's basically like recruiting recruitment for ICE, posters all over the place, $50,000 signing bonus, no questions asked, you're a thug with a firearm, there's no badges. Interestingly, apparently they're now going to get body cams, but you still don't know who they are, etc. Right? So, you know, what's the long-term one on this is you provoke enough democratic anger that you create instability in these cities, and that allows you to occupy them with first with National Guard troops and then with federal troops. And then you declare that the midterms, because you're in trouble, can't take place in this crisis environment, and therefore you don't have them, and then more emergency measures, whatever. And, you know, you're creeping towards burning the Reichstag, essentially, in a declaration of state of emergency, of which there are currently 22 states of emergencies in the United States at the moment. Now, that's the tail risk nightmare. How much is this actually going to pan out? Well, it turns out when you go around just shooting normal Americans in the face when they're backing away in their car, or when they're trying to help someone who you've beaten to the ground, public opinion doesn't necessarily go, J.D. Vance is right, that woman was obviously attacking them. They go, what? And it seems that there's a bit of pushback, and it seems that basically they might need to moderate their tactics. And if that's the case, running a full occupation strategy on this might have been something that everyone really liked over a drink when they were sitting in Mar-a-Lago, but might not actually be possible to pull it off. So I think, you know, as far as the tail risk is concerned, that's what that is. Now, in terms of the immigration policies themselves, the country has been very divided. Congress has, for political reasons, decided over 25 years not to have a comprehensive immigration review. Importations of people at the border have basically stopped. That's just done. Exports of people through ICE, etc., are actually now increasing. The United States, I believe, is now actually losing population for the first time in God knows how many years, if it's ever happened before. So this is being incredibly effective. So the real question is, let's just say that this is the project. It's just basically mass deportation. It is a kind of ethnic nationalist policy of favoring the natives, however the natives are defined. What are the consequences for this? Well, you know, one version of it, which, you know, you can associate with the kind of Steve Bannon National Conservative wing is, okay, this is great. You combine this with high tariffs, you onshore production, you've got your native population, so you've got tighter labor markets. That leads to higher wages. The way that firms pay for this is by using AI, etc., to augment, right? And then you basically end up restoring the American working class, job done. And then the other version is, it's not augment, it's substitution. This puts cost pressures on these firms. You actually don't have that much of a native population that is just able, willing, and, you know, mobile enough and skilled enough to move to wherever the new jobs are. This is what the IRA ran into as a problem. You can build a battery factory in Kansas, but when you haven't ever done it before, you don't have a lot of skilled labor around here that's able to do this. You need to invest in training. This takes time, etc. So the other version of this story is, this is shooting your own labor market in the head. Let's see how far it goes before you reverse. We'll see how it goes, but it doesn't look like they're going to reverse.
And you presented the tail risk and what could happen. How do you see this arc playing out in the next few months? And again, that sort of kind of strange coalition between the tech pros on the one hand and the MAGAs on the other, which at least in some areas have clearly different interests.
Oh yeah, very different interests. I mean,
so is it still holding up? How do you see this playing out in the next few months?
Well, it all pays through the quixotic figure of Trump himself. I mean, he is the movement, right? I mean, the counterfactual is, if Donald, you know, doesn't make it through natural causes to the next election, does MAGA fall apart? Nobody knows. Right. Now, we know that he's got, I think it's 400, God knows, whatever it is, billion, I can't even remember the number, an absurd amount of money in his war chest for fighting the midterms. And this has all been done by the tech lords. Like, they are his main backers. That's where it's coming from. And the tech lords' interests are really diverging from those of the MAGA base at this point in time, both in terms of foreign policy, domestic policy, et cetera, tariff, immigration, et cetera. They're just on different pages. In a sense, one is kind of like hardcore national nativist protectionist conservatism, and the other one is off the charts libertarianism. And while there are points of tangency, like, there are real points of contact or integration, and it's Trump that's holding this whole thing together, and also doing so by basically, I mean, just think about the past month, right? It's Venezuela. It's Greenland. No, it's not. It's Britain for that island they did. It's the Epstein files. No, it's not. Look over here. It's actually peace in Ukraine, but that's not going to happen. So now we're going to do a deal with India, right? And it's just constant flood the zone in motion, right? So, you know, where all this ends up, I literally have no idea. Nobody does.
So it's, do you see a strategy behind that, that, you know, you shift focus, you know, back and forth literally every day, and or is that just sort of erratic behavior, but guided by people in the background?
I think you can tell three different stories at once that are all simultaneously true. The first one is this all just distraction to keep the boss out of the Epstein files? Maybe. Is this essentially just a giant grab for everything that we can get in terms of anything from crypto to a market share, whatever, blah, 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 maybe. Is this a serious geopolitical and technological alignment whereby the world splinters into blocks based around fundamental energy technologies, information technologies, tech stacks, etc., and even currencies? Looks that way. So you've got all of that in the mix at once. If you want to tell a story that this is daily chaos, if you listen to the news every day, it's daily chaos because it just jumps around all the time. If you think about it in terms of hereditary blocks, what is he doing in Iran? What is he doing with Iran? Why does he care about that one, right? What's the end game there? You're not going to put boots on the ground in Venezuela. You're certainly not really going to start a war with Iran. What is the point of this, right? You tell Modi that he's a bad person, and then you tell him he's not a bad person because he's not going to take Russian oil. Of course he's going to take Russian oil. He's not in charge of it. It's basically a whole bunch of shadow fleet operators and dealers and broker dealers, etc. You know, it's a bit like to put this one on the table. Europe's the largest foreign investor in the United States, therefore it should use that power. How can it? That's like a million different investors in 27 different countries. You'd have to organize the world's most complex buyer strike. It's simply not going to happen, right? So with that level of complexity, I think you can tell any story you want. You can see anything you want. Do I think there's a long-term strategy here? Absolutely. It's not just random chaos. Can they get to where they want to go? It's a bit like the immigration story. If you believe that by throwing out X million people, you basically restore the American white working class, I guess you can tell that story. It's not one that I'm willing to believe, and not because I don't think it's a good goal, just because I don't think it can be done for various technological and social reasons, right? Labor market reasons. If you think, on the other hand, that hemispheric alignment is the way to go, because ultimately you've lost the green tech race with China, so we need to double down on what we've got a comparative advantage in, which is carbon, which means tying all of our allies into long-term carbon dependencies. Yeah, I think that's going on, right? Is there also a whole bunch of crap going on with cryptos and swindles and everything else? Yeah, it's true. It's all going on.
And if you take the perspective now from Europe, I mean, as you know, Mark Carney's speech at Davos made a big splash because it basically outlined what everybody basically
It said
knows.
Out loud what everyone was thinking, yes.
Exactly, what everybody knows to be true. First of all, it's a rupture, i.e. there is no going back to the situation ex ante. Second of all, we're all being bullied and the middle powers have to band together one way or the other.
Yes.
In order to form some sort of bloc. I mean, if you take now sort of your European hat on, you know, what would your advice be?
What should
Europe do and what order?
The first thing I would do is fire the head of NATO. Because to actually then turn around on the heels of that and say there's absolutely no way that Europe can defend itself without America doing it for them is, first of all, completely wrong, because we're already doing it. It's called grinding Russia to a halt in eastern Ukraine. The Ukrainians have already shown that they can defend themselves against the Russians. Are we seriously saying that the whole of Europe can't do this? Secondly, the real reasons that it's hard to do this is because of the reasons we outlined earlier, that basically we have too small, too fragmented, nationalistic procurement, no capital markets union, all of which is hard to get over. But the notion that we can't do this without America is literally the most supine, pathetic response I can think of, right? So the first one is that guy's got to go, or at least that attitude has got to go. But then the hard work starts, right? You're doubling down on F-35s. Come on, they've got a kill switch. Right, really? Do you want to spend that much money on someone? You go one day and you just don't get the software update and it doesn't work? That's a 15-year project figuring out how to do this. How are you going to get off? You've got a Galileo satellites, but you're going to have to like double or triple them if you ever want to have GPS coverage. But then you've got to decide who you're actually defending against and what are you actually for. And this is where it gets even more problematic, because if we think about the mismatch between sort of European multi-level technocratic governance, the ECB, et cetera, all the stuff that we like to focus upon, and then national politics. I mean, very shortly, France could be in the hands of the National Front. What happens at that point in terms of the attitude towards defense procurement? If AFD break the firewall, which it looks like they're going to do because all firewalls eventually fail, what happens then? So, you know, it's one thing to go, let's identify the problem. What needs to be done? And the really hard one is, okay, once you've identified it, can you really do anything about it? And that's where the guy who runs NATO might actually have a point. Right? It's not on the sort of like, you know, you can't do this, but to get to a position where you could, that's the really hard bit.
It certainly is, but you know, that external pressure is mounting, right?
Yeah.
So, and you know, you always have to grow, you have to grow with the challenge. I mean, if you think back to Germany a year ago, I mean, amending the debt brake to the tune of, you know, more than a trillion spending right. in defense and infrastructure, that was clearly not on the table.
But you notice that the commission to reform the debt brake is now deadlocked and is going to collapse.
Yeah, they're still working. They're still working on it. I have a few friends in there as well.
We've agreed that this is a bad idea, but we just can't pass the idea that we run the country like a corner shop.
Well, they're still working, but we'll see how we go. But at the moment, there is much more money on the table than there was previously. Mm-hmm. I mean, what is a bit worrying is that the US basically seems to have a strategy to subjugate Europe,
yes.
which is basically supporting the right-wing populists in every single country.
And also tying you into long-term carbon dependencies to derail yes. your green transition. This is actually very important as well. And then splitting off as many of the Eastern Europeans as you can from the core and basically fermenting through the populist parties, basically a sotto voce approach towards Russia, which then divides foreign policy. It's a pretty straightforward one.
You saw what Musk did with Alice Weidel, what he's been doing in the UK,
yeah.
you know, in supporting Tommy Robinson's march.
Oh, yeah.
And things like that. I mean, you mentioned France already. I mean, it's clearly that is a strategy that, you know, get rid of these European governments that seem to cling to ideas that, you know, mm-hmm. we don't share anymore. And that's the easiest, that type of regime change.
That is.
And that's to my mind, you know, and social media, you know, flooding the zone also there.
Absolutely.
That's clearly a big tool. And that's why they're so sensitive as regards regulation.
Well, this is the big one that's coming up, though, right? I mean, basically, now the rubber has hit the road with all of the digital rights, et cetera, et cetera. So the Americans basically were very, very cagey, even in the Biden administration, about the global minimum tax on corporations, and ended up putting a 15% domestic tax in because it was easier than getting it through Congress, et cetera, right? It's all very technical stuff. But the bottom line was the following. They really didn't want to pay a global minimum tax because it's lots of it is American corporations in foreign countries that are going to be paying the tax. So it becomes basically a tax on American companies. Now, when you regulate, as the European Union does, what can and cannot be said or done on social media channels, then basically you're regulating that space as well. And this is another one that the Americans are going to weaponize. They're really going to go for this one. This, you think Greenland's a fault line. This is the big one because the tech lords are heavily invested in MAGA as a project, this government as a project, and this government will go the line to defend their interests. And their interests are, I have the right to get my platform to say whatever it wants in your country and influence politics any way I want. And if you don't want to do that, you're against freedom of speech. That's how this is going to be played out. Now, the weakness is the following. You've got state regulators that are doing this because you've got European regulation that says that you can't do this. And we have this mismatch in Europe whereby you have a supranational organization that basically writes GDPR and data protection laws, et cetera, which is implemented into national law, which then has to be the thing. But that's weak because that was never national law. So once you get populists in place, that's the bit that you strip out. That's the bit that you start to challenge. And that's really deadly for EU authority.
Yeah, but I mean, that's clearly shaping up to be the key battleground. I mean, you saw that the French authorities raided X offices in Paris in the last few days.
Yeah.
And you know the German context also very well. I mean, you know, denying the Holocaust or anything like that.
All of which are deep, reasonable public policy positions to have within a national government, within a national economy, right? Within a national society. For years and years, people forget, you know, America restricted the right of people to be communists, right? You know, we've never had absolute freedom of speech. It's complete rubbish, right? But it is now weaponized in such a way against Europe that what was 10 years ago a totally reasonable thing to do, should we protect children against pornography, is now a freedom issue. You know, that's just like, how did that
happen? And also fake. Right?
Yeah, so totally.
It's not just, can we just make it up at the same time? You know,
no, absolutely.
That's why I play games again. Mark, we've already been going on for 40 minutes. I mean, I agree. I think the digital regulation, tech regulation will probably be in a key battleground between the United States and Europe, particularly in this year. And we'll see how this shapes
up. And I hate to sound Trumpy on this one, but like, you got no cards. You got no cards, right? Because, well, what are we going to do? Deny you the LNG exports? All right, good luck sourcing them from Qatar. That'll cost you a fortune. We'll just put more tariffs up again. That's it. We'll deliberately target the German car industry, right? I mean, they've just got so many weapons, and it's such a one-sided battle at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, they're already diversifying. I mean, we've got a contract with Qatar, and, you know, Lula, just switch it off. Right.
Right.
So,
Lula
just having none of it.
Yeah. There's an interesting one. I wonder if these social media bans, which started in Australia, which now has been mooted in Spain, isn't a trial balloon for like, well, what happens if we just switch this shit off? Because you could have other platforms. You just have to get people an API to migrate, and then you can have your own domestic platforms. But to do that, you need your own cloud. You got to build the clouds.
Yes, but people are getting tired of social media to start with. I mean, a few months ago in the FT, there was a nice data journalism article that basically showed that social media use peaked in 2022.
Yeah, I think that's right.
And it's been on the decline.
I used to do a lot of it, and then basically you realize that like one third of the traffic that you're getting through X now is bots and basically stuff that you would never ask for in a million years. And you're like, why am I doing this? It's a waste of time.
Yeah, I wouldn't know because I haven't been on X since way before Elon Musk took over. we'll see. And
you were an early adopter.
I was an early adopter and an early leaver. The same for Facebook. Mark, it's been great to talk to you as always. We'll have to play it by ear this year and see how things are shaping up. And, you know, we'll see in the autumn, you know, where we are just in the run-up to the midterms.
Well, I'll tell you where I will be if all goes well. I will be in France.
In France? Why France?
Yes, because I'm going to be on leave. So I'm going to be in a vineyard with my feet up watching this from a distance. But the good news is I can come to Berlin and we can do our next chat in person.
That would be fantastic. Great.
Excellent.
So let's definitely do that.
All right.
All the best and talk to you soon.
Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
This is Social Europe Podcast. We are dedicated to strengthening democracy by discussing the most pressing political, economic, and social issues of our time. So welcome and enjoy the conversation.